This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest, the podcast which brings reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and instead went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, and streaming media. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me this week are Richard Hawes.
Hello, everyone.
And Stephen Lockridge.
Hello.
This week, we have Anthony Hopkins turning up in The Virtuoso. Then we have the latest Amazon Prime film, Without Remorse, based on Tom Clancy's characters. Then we're off for a voyage with The Ninth Passenger. And then off to Germany with has-been action star Jack Walker. And we're going to round up with The Bike Thief. Our short shot this week is a Batman film, Batman Other Worlds, and our DTV throwback is a film called Zulu. No, not the Michael Caine one. This stars Orlando Bloom and Forrest Whitaker. So without further ado, let's crack on. Our first review then is The Virtuoso. When an innocent bystander is accidentally killed during a hit, a professional assassin finds himself having a crisis of confidence. His handler decides to give him another job to work on, one in which he will have to try and figure out who the actual target is. I think straight off the bat, guys, this is a film that you're going to struggle with unless you like wall-to-wall narration.
Yes, without a doubt.
In which case, my wife would hate it because she absolutely hated Accident Man for that very reason. There's a lot to like here, actually. We have this guy, this assassin. He is a professional, a virtuoso, if you will. He takes great pride in his work. He has Anthony Hopkins as his very creepy handler. We'll get onto that in a bit. And you know, I actually found sort of parallels between this and the Ben Affleck film The Accountant. You know, mood, you know, the kind of mood of it, quite liked. Steve, let's hear what you think about this.
It's enjoyable. I mean, it starts off with an absolute shocker of a scene, and then goes into another one. Then it slows right down and gets, like I say, it moves like an iceberg. It's that slow moving, but it's interesting. You've got like the setup in the cafe where you think there's like at least four different assassins or people that he's sent to kill. So he's got to work out which one it is. And I thought the acting was absolutely phenomenal. Anson Mount, who I didn't recognise from Star Trek at first. It took me a while to recognise who he was. It was great. Abby Cornish as well as the waitress. Eddie Marsan, you know, David Morse. The cast is absolutely incredible, really, when you think about it. And you throw Anthony Hopkins in there as well. The only issue I've got is at points it does... The narration just takes over too much, to be fair. It's like filmmaking for idiots. It's explaining too much, right? You know, like Mark Kimmel says, show, don't tell.
Yeah.
And this is tell and show as well at the same time. And the twist end, you can see coming a mile off. But yeah, overall, not too bad.
Rich, your initial thoughts on this one?
Yeah, well, the narration thing was really struck me as well, because, you know, it's very similar to various other things, but Dexter came to mind, the serial killer TV series, because that's like led by narration all the way through. Very similar kind of thing going on. The whole setup of plus how methodically is, that's kind of a Dexter trait as well. But the idea of this methodical hitman, you know, the haunted hitman, you know, it's kind of been, it's a very, very well-worn storyline. I've never seen The American with George Clooney, but that was the one that came to mind for me in terms of it's kind of got like a slow because I've heard that's a very slow paced kind of Hitman story, right, or whatever. You know, he goes to this village or something, and I thought that's kind of a bit similar to what's happening here. But what was the other one you mentioned, Mike?
On the way? Accountant.
The Accountant. I haven't seen that either, so I can't say. But the he's like that's the one where he's an autistic assassin, isn't it? Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
The Anson Mount's really good. He stands out. it's like a sore thumb, you know, wherever he goes or whatever. So he's not very inconspicuous. Yeah. And the cast is, Anson Mount's walking around in this high turtleneck and whatnot. And he's kind of inhuman. But you know, the whole idea is that hardness being sort of worn away gradually. And, you know, there's the whole thing with the dog and, you know, the burgeoning relationship and that, you know, it's like, even something like Malone with Burt Reynolds came to mind, because, you know, he arrives in the town, the relationship and whatever. We've seen it a lot of it. I think this is probably a fairly low budget movie, but, you know, they have attracted this fantastic cast, not least of course, Anthony Hopkins. This isn't a Randall Emmett production of, you know, like one of these Bruce Willis or whatever movies where you get someone in, but it is the same strategy basically. And Hopkins is, you know, they do credit him as so there's nothing misleading there. We know he's not going to be in a huge amount, but he does have some quite big scenes. I mean, his main piece is a really long monologue. That
fucking creepy and nightmarish monologue, if you ask me. Yeah. That was horrible to listen to.
Yeah.
What he was describing was horrific. It really was. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's worth the price of admission or whatever, as you would say, for kind of that little moment alone. You know, that is a power. You know, that shows why he's a highly regarded. You know, he's just won the blooming Oscar again, hasn't he? Or whatever. Or, I don't know if it's the first time, but he's just won. He's just won it.
I think so, he Remains of the Day, didn't he? Back in.
Yeah, that's right. So, Shadowlands?
Silence of the Lambs.
Oh yeah.
Oh, did he actually win it for Silence?
Yeah, he did.
Okay. Silence of the Lambs is a funny one to win the Oscar for, I would say. But, you know, anyway, that's a digression. Yeah. But he's a fantastic presence. At times I was thinking, is he playing, you know, is he typical Welsh Anthony Hopkins, or is he doing an American accent? But he kind of wandered into an accent at times, I think, but it didn't bother me too much. Mm. But everyone else is really good. Abbey Cornish is quite brave with the role, you could say. You know, she's sort of... a very interesting character to play. Again, they're all sort of kind of, they're all kind of what, archetypes or whatever you call them. I'd like maybe some of the other elements perhaps to be a bit more fleshed out, but I wasn't bothered by any of it. I mean, you know, like some of the other, you know, we've got some, you know, Eddie Marsden, for example, is a fantastic actor. Mm. Doesn't really have anything to do. He's kind of got he sits at the bar, then he has like one other scene where he's got a couple of lines. But I was listening to the director's commentary, which comes on the disc release of this film from I can't remember who's releasing. Can you remember who's releasing it?
Not a fan.
No, sorry. So I can't credit them. But for the DVD. And the director, the writer director, was saying how he was amazed that he was able to, you know, kind of get all these people, and, you know, how he wanted a big name actor to come in and do his movie or whatever. To, you know, and he managed to get Anthony Hopkins, and he managed to get Eddie Mars, and he was in awe of kind of the cast that he was, and rightly so, you know. I think this raises it up, above so many other films of a similar thing. I think the fact that Anson Mount perhaps doesn't have the name recognition that somebody else does kind of put it in that Bruce Willis movie category. But I think it is a cut above your Anti-Lifes and whatnot.
Yes.
To me. I think it's a very very overly familiar, but very solid thriller.
Yeah.
I was, funny enough, I was talking about this film with my dad earlier today, because he's a bit of a sort of nitpicky kind of guy, and he did point out a rather big flaw. Well, not a big flaw, but a particularly silly moment late in the film, where a particular character has a gun, and he's taken like the first bullet out of the gun, out of the chamber.
My dad,
you know, because the idea is that, you know, he's taking the bullet out of the chamber, so, you know, the other character,
somebody else can't use it. Yeah.
So he pulls the trigger, and, you know, you have to have that sort of pause as to what to do. As my dad pointed out, with an automatic, if you take the one bullet out of the chamber, all the gun does is load the next bullet into the chamber.
So
it wouldn't make any difference at all.
Ah, but you see, people like me, general viewers, don't know that much about guns. Perhaps the director didn't know that much about guns. Exactly. Perhaps the armourer didn't know that much about guns. I don't know.
Maybe that discussion was had on set and they were... fuck it, we'll go with it.
I don't have a problem with that.
but it's just like...
Good observation, though.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure there'll be a lot of... You know, when this comes out, there'll be a lot of nitpickers on IMDb going, oh, bloody hell. It's like a guns work city. Anyway,
but it's like you're quite good with sounds of weapons, aren't you? You're quite good with recognizing
I do pick up on that. Yeah, I must admit, if every gun sounds the same on set, or, you know, in the film or whatever. But anyway, I did like this. Even though the narration is a little bit too intrusive, and they should trust what's being shown on screen a bit more.
Oh, now here's what I was thinking, and I want to run this past you. Do you think the film would work without the narration? Because I think it would have been a fantastic opportunity if they'd made that an optional track. You know, you could watch it with the narration or without the narration.
Yeah, give us the Deckard cut, basically.
Yeah. I think it would, but I don't think the studio would have the balls to do it.
No. I think it needed, realistically, somewhere halfway between. Because some of it, it's interesting to hear, you know, his thought process. But other times, it's like, well, you're showing us this stuff, you know, you don't need to sort of explain it at the same time. But other than that, this was a surprise. I, again, like Into the Labyrinth in a previous episode, you know, with a big name attached to a production we hadn't heard about.
Yeah, yeah.
It has surprised me. I thought, you know, and again, you know, you mentioned the Bruce Willis films that we've, you know, had to cover in the past, and you kind of expect that, you know, that's what we've been led to expect. You know, these big names appearing in this sort of no-name cast film with a no-name director, and you're kind of expecting that level, not every star is as non-picky as Bruce Willis, shall we say, and you know, they do choose their roles a bit more wisely. So, yeah, how are we going to score the Virtuoso? So let me kick off. I'm going to give this a 7 out of 10.
7 from me as well.
Steve?
Yeah, I'll go over 7.
3 sevens for the Virtuoso. So the only caveat we'll say is that, yeah, it is narration heavy, very narration heavy. But the acting's great. The cast is great.
How do you feel about the running time? Because it's quite long.
I must admit, I didn't really notice it. You know, I mean, which is a good sign, really, isn't it? You know, if you're not noticing how long a film is, then I think it's doing something right.
Yeah,
because as Steve was saying, it's quite a slow burn, but it's about it's an hour and 45 minutes, basically.
It's
a slow burn, but it needs it.
Yeah,
in a way, you know, it doesn't overstay its welcome. I don't think
once you get past Anthony Hopkins' horrific monologue, it sort of turns into this sort of procedural, you know, as he's having to sort of investigate these other people in the bar or the cafe or whatever it's called, and investigate, you know, which one could be the target. And yeah, it's not the fastest pace, but at the same time, it's very methodical, and you know, you're following along with him. So yeah, I didn't mind that at all. So yeah, no, running time be damned. I thought it was still a good 7 out of 10.
And it's out from Lionsgate Home Entertainment.
Our next review is Without Remorse. Following a tough mission in Syria, a team of Navy SEALs find themselves targeted by a team of Russian assassins. John Kelly survives one such attack, but his pregnant wife isn't so lucky. When he recovers from his injuries, Kenny goes on a vengeance-soaked warpath to find those responsible. I should have sort of started this by saying it is Tom Clancy's Without Remorse. It's sort of plastered all over Amazon at the moment. It's their big sort of latest sort of flagship, starring Michael B. Jordan. How do we like this one? Let's go with Rich to begin with.
Yeah, I think it's good. It's kind of your typical Hollywood, you know, thriller. The fact that it's bypass cinemas and Amazon have bought it, I think, is purely a result of the pandemic. I think if you know, Paramount, it could be that Paramount were eager to sell it off in the same way they did when Cloverfield Paradox went to Netflix. But I kind of doubt that. I think this would have done really well in the cinema. You know, there's really Jordan's got, you know, he's a up and comer, you know, he's doing really well on the back of, you know, Creed and Creed 2 and everything. And obviously he's going to be directing the third one, following the trajectory of kind of Sylvester Stallone, funnily enough, where he went, moved into directing. And the cast is, you know, solid. We've got Guy Pearce and Jamie Bell. Jamie Bell being in it reminded me of him when he was because here he's a supporting character, but when he did 6 Days, yeah, which also went to Netflix as well. That's a very solid, you know, fact-based kind of military kind of thing. But this is a fantasy. This is from Tom Clancy's, you know, universe. What I didn't realize until after I'd seen the film and, you know, looking into it a bit more is the whole John Kelly, mm-hmm. yep. or John Clark. He was in the Jack Ryan books, basically, and then then he wrote Without Remorse, which was like his fourth book, where he focused specifically on this character, gave him backstory and all this sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I'd never realized until now the whole interconnectedness of all the Jack Ryan stuff, but Liev Schreiber and Willem Dafoe have both previously played this particular character.
That's correct.
That's all quite interesting to me, not realizing any of that. But yeah, it's the whole...
Did you realise the other connection?
No, go on. Well, I might have, I don't know.
I might have done, but Karen Greer, played by Jodie Turner-Smith, she is the niece of James Earl Jones's character, Admiral Greer.
Oh, okay. In Clear and Present Danger.
Well, in all of them, yeah. Clear and Present Danger, I mean, the character pops up a lot, basically.
So. Yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah. Yeah, I think there's the whole.
Yeah, there's Morgan Freeman played him in The Sum of All Fears.
The Sum of All Fears, yeah. Yeah, because Liev Schreiber played Clark in that one. So Sum of All Fears was brilliant. I really like that film a lot. This was good, entertaining. The thing is, it was kind of, I thought it was setting it up like a revenge movie. I mean, it is a revenge movie, but it kind of started off that opening scene, you know, not the original opening scene, but, you know, like where the team starts to get taken out.
Yeah.
And the guy's taking out his rubbish. That's Commando. Totally out of Commando. Yeah. It's like completely out of Commando. But wow, what a twist on it. I mean, I did not see that. And that visual effect on how they did that was absolutely amazing. I had to go back and, you know, I had to rewind and look at it again, because you cannot tell how they did it. It's fantastic movie magic. The horrific, obviously, but fantastic movie magic. So we got those scenes from Commando, and then it goes hard to kill, basically. And you think, oh, he's going to be, it's going to be him on his own or whatever. And then no, actually he teams up with a unit and they go on a mission and stuff. And I got a bit, I wasn't that bothered about, I'm not really big on kind of, you know, mission, you know, stuff and the whole thing in Russia, you know, it was fine. You know, everything sort of feels a bit Mission Impossible, and there's some twists and turns. There's an airplane set piece as well earlier. So yeah, I thought it was fine. I just don't think it's particularly memorable.
Okay. Steve, what do you make of this one?
Yeah, like I say, it's kind of like United's revenge thriller with like a bit of Commando thrown in. I enjoyed it. It's solid rather than staggering, you know. It's,
yeah.
Performances are good, especially like Jodie Smith. I thought she was really good in it. And Michael B. Jordan. I think, I don't think I've seen him do anything bad, I don't, you know, at all. I think he's a great actor. I specifically liked Jamie Bell as well, because he's just a creepy little fucker in it.
In this,
you know, he's just this little slimy turd who's in the background. It's like Bingy out of Aliens.
Exactly, yeah. That's exactly who I thought of. Paul Reiser.
You know, but he gets. Well, we'll leave it at that. But yeah, it's solid, more than spectacular, enjoyable. I did like the actual action sequence in Russia with the mission.
Mm-hmm.
There's some really good shots in there. I liked how it was done. It just seemed that it could have gone a bit bigger in budget, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
The action sequences, I thought, were quite cheap for your normal Hollywood movie. But I think, having said that, they were kind of going for a military realism more than over the top, you know. So yeah. It's definitely not your John Wick kind of thing. but yeah, no, I enjoyed it. It was good. I would recommend it.
Yeah, no, I certainly would, especially since it's on Prime. I mean, what excuse have you got, really?
No,
sort of 2 hours. And again, you know, this is a film that we looked at the running time. My wife went, really? 2 hour film? Oh, whatever, you know. But I didn't really notice the time once the killing started. Well, even my wife, you know that first bit where they come up through the sort of the sewage pipe into that pool and take out the two guards. My wife's like, whoa, okay, you know. She's into it from then. But yeah, the only problem I have with it really is the plot. In that it feels very old-fashioned, you know, this idea of, oh, we want to start a war with Russia because that's when we were the most powerful and stuff like that. I'm thinking,
you're not giving away the twist there, are you?
No. But I mean, Rich, you mentioned that this was basically the fourth Tom Clancy novel, which basically would have meant it was written sort of towards the end of the 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, I think it was 1993, but I'm just going to...
So, you know...
Yeah, 1993.
So, you know, that sort of... You know, the Cold War was still quite, you know, not exactly recent, but, you know, the wounds would have still been fresh, basically. So you can kind of see that, you know, Tom Clancy would have written about something like this then. And they've tried to sort of update it, to, you know, to try to modernize it as much as possible. But they're still stuck with this core idea of motivation. And it does sort of, it just makes you say, really? You know, a little bit? It's like, is that really the motive? But there you go. Maybe that's just me. I like
well, the getting to the...
I like the plain scene.
Getting to the... Yeah. No, so getting with the just sort of picking up on your point around the sort of plot and the you know, the sort of overarching plan without giving it away or anything, but it does, you know, I kind of got to that point and I was just like, this again?
Exactly.
You know, it's like, exactly. I've seen a lot of that recently, you know, I seem to have seen a lot of that, especially recently, of that particular motivation of and what they were actually trying to achieve is did you watch the mid credits as well?
Oh no, missed that one.
So you didn't get the Avengers moment then?
No.
So there's a mid-credits scene, which is the whole setting up the franchise bit. Everyone needs to stay tuned for that.
Yeah, I hope they do sort of come up with another one. I mean, this does feel like a lot of setup. You know, I was like kind of surprised when they sort of name dropped Clark at the end. I was like, oh, right, now I get it. It's all set up for future adventures.
Didn't mean anything to me at the time, but so I sort of go in and I thought, oh, okay, and I research it. On a related note, I also watched the video game tie-in Agent Origins Tom Clancy's The Division Agent Origins, which was a web series, and they put it together as like a half-hour movie a few years ago.
I really like that, that's
really good. I thought that was that was a good little project, but that's just a side note.
I was a fan of the game as well, but yeah, that was really cool. Yeah, so scores on the doors for Without Remorse. Rich?
I think, you know, for forgettable popcorn viewing, it's definitely, you know, a 7, I'd say. Mm.
Yep, and Steve?
Yeah, I'll probably go 7.
Yep, can't disagree with either of you. I'm giving it a 7 as well. This is good stuff. It really is.
I just want to mention, sorry, before we go, the fight coordinator on the film was a guy called Can Aiden, who's from the Real Deal Stunt Collective. He's done some fantastic work. He's doing Second Unit and you know, directing and that. He's done various things, like he was Frank Grillo's stunt double in Wolf Warrior 2, and he's Keanu's stunt double for Matrix 4, but he's also, he was the action director of Steven Seagal's Attrition, and him and his team made a film called Plan B, which is quite hard to find. You know, it's not had very good distribution, but there's a lot of really great little short films online that you can find, like on YouTube. There's one that the only film so far that he's directed, which was called Bad Choice, which I don't know if you guys had a chance to look at, but it stars Sam Hargrave and it's got a nice little twist at the end of it. It's an action short. It's like several minutes long. Well worth checking out. The Real Deal Stunt guys are kind of on the rise at the moment. Actually, this guy did the action on Skylines as well. He was a second unit director of that. So, you know, there's a lot of good people involved in this film you know, should check out some of their other work as well.
Yeah. In fact, I just one other thing. You mentioned that Jamie Bell was played Ritter in this. I did not recognize him. He was that good in the role, you know, and that stupid bloody chin strap beard probably put me off as well. but I'm a big fan of Jamie Bell's, you know. I mean, you mentioned, you know, what's it called, 6 Days?
Yeah, 6 Days. Yeah, the Embassy Siege film.
And he was also the best thing in that really horrible film called, is it called Filth? One of the sequels to Trainspotting.
Oh, you mean the James McAvoy one?
Yeah.
Yeah,
in that, and he was really good. Yeah, because he had a Scottish accent in that, and he was really good. You know, he's totally, you know, well, obviously he's grown up since Billy Elliot. But I really like the guy, you know, his acting. So, yeah, anyway, we digress. 3 7s.
Digressions. Yep.
3 7s for Without Remorse. Check it out. It's on Amazon Prime. Our next review is The Ninth Passenger. An industrial spy finds himself trapped on board a luxury yacht when the owner's yuppie son decides to take it for a spin in order to trap his girlfriend into listening to him. Yeah, long story, which we'll get into in a sec. However, that is not the end of his nor the other 7 people on board's problems that evening. Rich, you can add up, can't you?
Yes. I was adding up when I was watching it. So I was trying to work out
how many people, because it's obviously it's called The Ninth Passenger, so we were trying to work out, so we've got Jesse Metcalf playing this industrialist spy guy who goes on board the thing to try and find some papers. On board, we have supposedly the captain who's taken along this blonde date of his, and unbeknownst to her, set up a spy cam so he can record what happens. But actually, he's not the captain. It's belongs to this rich industrialist who we don't actually meet, but his son is there with his best mate. His girlfriend turns up, as well as these two other girls who they met that night and tried to chat up. I mean, is this really a chat up line? Hey girls, my mate's just been chucked by his girlfriend. Would you like to hang out with us? It's like, okay, so he got dumped by his other girlfriend, but you think he's good enough for us?
That is quite a common one. I'm sure I've seen that in loads of teen movies.
Oh, come on, you know. But yeah,
and it's always that same character who says it. It's always that douchebag kind of character.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So it really did feel like this is an old script, right? Which I'll come into in a minute. But anyway, so on board, we actually have eight people, including Jesse Metcalf and these other people. And then the main boy decides to take the boat for a spin so his girlfriend can't get off the boat so he can get her alone and talk to her about something. That was the weird part as well, Rich, the fact that, you know, he's sort of saying that he'd been dumped by his girlfriend, and then she turns up and gets really upset when she seems to be with somebody else, which is like, okay, I don't know, teens, man.
Yeah.
So this film, it's for the most part, it's this sort of weird, it's almost like a bedroom farce to a certain degree. And then the last 10 minutes of the film are this sort of tacked on bit. You know, it sort of changes genres all of a sudden. It's very strange. Let's hear some of your thoughts on this one, Rich.
Actually, could I throw it over to Steve first? Because I'd like to get his feedback.
I think you watched it, did you?
Did you not watch it? Oh.
Is it gone?
No, I didn't see this one.
Oh, yeah, I didn't see this one.
Oh, you didn't see this one. I apologise. Right. So, I didn't have a problem with it for the most part. I thought it was fine. I mean, they do this whole thing of introducing Jesse Metcalf's character, who was also in, not the character, but Jesse Metcalf, who was in Hard what Kill. Was it called?
Hard Kill,
yeah, with Bruce Willis.
Bruce.
He kind of, it's a very cheap movie, and he kind of, because he's in it, it kind of brings a little bit of something, because he, you know, he's got some star quality about him. They do this thing of you know, it's smoking as a character, you know, as a character trait, you know, something to signify the shorthand of, you know, he's perhaps a bit of a dubious character and stuff they do, but you know, we get, you know, different revelations about him as it goes on, which is fine. The whole teens getting together on the yacht was silly, but I kind of had fun with it. You know, it's the millennials kind of rich mixture, but you know, there's like the really, really wealthy sort of preppy guys, like I thought that was a bit too on the nose, because he's wearing like this really, really smart polo shirt. So he's almost walking around with a jumper tied around his neck, kind of look, sort of, you know, like the tennis pitch. Club.
Yeah, it's that old Abercrombie and French sort of thing, isn't it?
There's the sort of eco warrior kind of character, and this kind of plays into the plot of this wealthy industrialist guy who's basically destroying the planet, who owns the boat and everything, and what secrets are on there, and why is this guy there? You know, why is Jesse Metcalf's character there? What's he there to get? Industrial espionage or whatever it is. The where it fell down, I think, was okay. So they get on the boat, they venture out, and they end up at this island, which by complete coincidence seems to be owned by the father who owns the boat. You know, the fact, I mean, I know he was in town for a meeting, but the chances of them actually getting to that particular island just sort of seemed a bit far-fetched, unless I missed something. And, but the main problem I had with the film was that it had no ending. It just kind of has some stuff happening and then doesn't resolve anything.
Nope.
There's literally no you know, we got the revelation of the ninth passenger and stuff, but
Do we, Rich? That... Do we? Was he even a passenger, or was he just somebody who was on the boat on the island?
Well, it's been a couple of weeks. Yeah. Well, I'd go. I don't want to spoil any potential enjoyment because I might have misunderstood it. But I'll speak to you about it off air about what my particular interpretation of it was. But yeah, I just felt there was. I mean, it does. You're right. It does shift gears. It changes because it starts out, and I was thinking, oh, it's going to be kind of a. I haven't seen Donkey Punch, but you know, it's that kind of thing. You know, that something bad's going to happen on the boat and whatnot. But actually, they move away from the boat. So other stuff is happening. I wasn't as engaged, but I kind of lost a bit of interest. And then, you know, creature attacks kind of thing happens. It's fine, but you know. It didn't do a huge amount for me. I was just really disappointed by that ending. It's a Canadian film, by the way. I thought that was quite interesting. That,
I don't know how many mysterious islands are off the coast of Vancouver, but anyway.
Yeah, I didn't. Well, yeah, was it set? There because
basically, there somebody mentions, you know, oh, how long you're in Vancouver for or something.
Oh, okay, yeah, fair enough. Yeah, so it must be a mysterious island off of Vancouver, because they didn't actually go very, you know, what are they on the water for like an hour, really, and then they get to this place, and then they find the other. They find this. It must have been a really small island because they found the place like within like 2 seconds, which also it kind of made me think of House of the Dead and stuff as well with all that. But.
The script is very strange. It's based on a book called Swim Rat Swim. By an author called Jack Kalfa. Now, that book was published in 1960 and has been out of print for God knows how long. This guy, he wrote a lot of stuff. You know, he's like a naturist. No, he said naturalist. He's a naturist who, you know, had sort of ties with Hollywood and things like that. He did sort of stuff about animals working in Hollywood, amongst other things. And he'd written this book. And judging by the cover, it had something to do with sharks in the original book, at least. And it's been updated. But even in sort of the updated version, it feels like a film from the 80s. Not just because of sort of the sort of very dodgy sort of sexual politics going on. You know, I mentioned the thing about the guy with the spy cam sort of filming his date, and she finds it and confronts him with it, and he's like, oh, he sort of kind of laughs it off, and then she sort of goes, well, it's still not the worst date I've ever had, so come on, let's carry on. I was like, oh, for God's sake. You know, it is literally the most unwoke script you know, that's been gone into production in the last sort of 10 years, I think. But even when they sort of leave the harbour, when they come out of the harbour, you've got this sort of montage of the ship and everyone, sort of people sort of doing silly stuff. And the song they choose, I can't remember what it's called, but it sounded so 80s. You know, it was like the Flock of Seagulls or something, but not, you know, it was really bizarre. So it felt like this sort of weird, anachronistic sort of script for me. And it just, I had no clue, because I hadn't looked at the artwork for this before I watched it. You know, I literally had no clue who the ninth passenger was going to actually be. And I was expecting something more of a sort of stalk and slash kind of thing, where maybe the sort of cast are sort of, you know, knocked off one by one. And maybe sort of Jesse Metcalf gets blamed for it because he's the one who isn't supposed to be there and all this. And it turns into something completely different. And as you say, it's almost as if they, you know, got to a certain point of filming and thought, you know what, there's all these sort of rubber creature suits back here. Shall we use them? You know, that's kind of how it felt, that last, you know, the last part of the film. It has a sort of slapped on prologue as well. I was a bit worried it was going to be in media res. It's not, but it is sort of like there just to try and mirror what happens at the end a little bit. I thought it was like the Coast Guard or something turning up at the beginning. Turns out maybe it wasn't. Could be something else, because I think it's the same boat that turns up at the end. Rich, how are you going to score this?
I mean, it doesn't have an ending, so I'm going to have to. It's going to have to be a low one. I think I'm going to go 5. You know, it accepts borderline, you know, acceptable, but you know, not having the ending is a big problem for me. You want to watch a film like this? Watch Sea Fever. You know, it's a much better film.
Yeah. Or what's that other one called? There's a film that Roald Rain did, which was he basically remade his own film, and one of them has Jules Strait in it. I can't remember what it's called something like At Dawn We Die or something like that. One of them was called Primeval. I'm pretty sure of it with Henriksen.
Yeah, I've heard about Primeval. I've heard about the him remaking it thing, but I haven't seen it.
I like both versions of that. Anyway, I digress. I'm giving this a 5 as well, and mainly that what's keeping it at a 5, you know, in a good way, is the scene with the spear gun. I really liked that bit. That was stupid but fun. That gets a 5 out of 10. So unfortunately, the artwork for the DVD gives a lot of this away. We've been reasonably coy about what's going on, but the artwork gives it away straight up. So you're kind of expecting something completely different to what we were expecting when we watched it. But anyway, do check it out if you like that sort of thing. 2 5s from the DTV Digest for The Ninth Passenger. Our next film is Jack Walker. Jack Walker was once the toast of Hollywood, making action blockbusters such as Nuclear Tanker, Dark Demons, and Revenge Served Twice. Now, however, he is in the Where Are They Now pile, trying to make something of a comeback in a small budget movie opposite another once famous actress, Sylvia Meadows. Even though he's working with a talented stunt crew, Jack is finding his road back difficult because his pride and vanity are getting in the way. However, unbeknownst to anyone, the film location is also being used as a drop-off for a local drug lord, and soon the whole crew are being held hostage, and it's up to Jack and stuntman Chris to save the day. I started off hating this film, mainly because of the pacing of it, and I just wish somebody went in with a pair of more sort of judicious scissors and edited the hell out of it, because scenes just dragged and dragged. And I was sort of sat there wondering what the hell happened to the soundtrack, because there's no score for a lot of this when there really needs to be. However, this film really warmed to me, or I warmed to it, I should say. The more it went on, the more I sort of got into the character. The other stuntmen, because we've got the likes of Mike Muller involved in this and his stunt team. And it does become a really good film as it goes on. It's still got issues with editing and some of the acting, but it's a fun film. I really did enjoy it. Steve, what did you make of this?
No, it didn't sit well with me. It's supposed to be like a action comedy. Wasn't funny in the slightest. I didn't even giggle or chuckle once. Jack Walker is, to be honest, is a bit of an annoying prick, especially the first half of the movie. The second half, you warm to him slightly, but yeah, it just didn't bode well with me. The only part I really enjoyed was the stunt team. I thought they were great. The moves they were pulling off, the behind the scenes bit, showing how they did it and what they had to do, and that I loved. And when they came into their own in the second half of the film, again, their scenes were great. And the tonal shift where the baddies show up, and it just becomes, the script just becomes a ream of cliches that they're going to say, and he's going to, look, the baddies, I'm the director now, and we're going to do this. Oh, God, it's the worst baddie I've seen in about 10 years. He was so goddamn annoying, and he was chewing the scenery like there's no tomorrow. I just could not get on with him at all. The rest of the cast were okay, but him and Jack, what the good and the baddie were the most annoying things about it, I think. I mean, obviously, you've got it's a very, very small budget by the looks of it. And they kind of played to the strengths, and yeah, the stunt team were the best thing about it.
You're looking at the film and you're kind of thinking the actual film budget is probably less than the budget for the film that they're actually filming, if you see what I mean. The fictional film in the film probably has a bigger budget than theirs does, and theirs is tiny. Rich, any redeeming features in this one for you?
Oh yeah, definitely. The budget is a problem because the concept of the film is undermined by the fact that it's such a low budget film, because it's the concept of it is basically a variation on JCVD. Mm. You know, you kind of you're expected to sort of buy into this guy being this incredibly massive superstar who starred in these big movies or whatever, but casting an unknown and then not having the budget to like have, you know, even some scenes, some trailers or something that establishes that character in the universe, it doesn't work. You know, they've got a couple of posters that they, you know, the posters are quite fun that they put on the wall in his house, whatever, but they're not convincing enough to sell the world. So it just feels like, is he really a big, or is he, you know, is he a you know, a star in sort of low budget director video or whatever, but they're talking about him like he's Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Mm.
You know, it's like it's supposed to be Arnold Schwarzenegger is what the thing is here. But the guy playing him, I didn't have a huge Stefan Moravec. It's what's interesting is this is a German film that feels like a British comedy, like a Britcom kind of thing, or at least partly. Because that's another of the weird things is, and this kind of ties in with Welcome to Sudden Death, which we talked about a while back, is it's an action movie that feels like a sitcom. You know, it's low budget. It's shot in that kind of sitcom way that makes it feel like a TV thing. It felt like I was watching an episode of Hoff the Record, the David Hasselhoff British sitcom, comedy series. It was the brilliant series. Also, you know, because that worked because it was about a faded icon, David Hasselhoff playing David Hasselhoff. It worked. So that was a similar kind of thing of what they're trying to do here. Now, where it kind of falls down is they kind of set it up with this comedy, but then they lose the comedy. It becomes kind of a straight action movie. And I think it kind of falls somewhere between the two. I was reminded of the film Night Shooters that we watched a while back, which was also about a film crew getting into, getting in over the head with the situation and whatnot. And then obviously the martial arts action thrown in. And this is Day Shooters, because the whole film is shot in the day, which is also unusual. It's like an action movie. Yeah. Everything takes place in daylight. It's all taking place in this hotel. There's not really anyone there. And, you know, it's kind of sparse. But, you know, if it wasn't for the fact that they said it's in Germany, you would not know it's in Germany. It could have been in the Lake District.
Yeah.
But as Steve said, the action, when it kicks in, Mike Muller's, he's the leader. He's the action team guy. That's really, really good stuff with Mike himself leading the way. Steve, he deserves to be working on much, much better films than this. I'm not saying that they haven't done a good job with this. It's, you know, the guy who, the director, Tane Genko Ulgen, funnily enough, I mentioned Attrition earlier. He also worked on that. He was an action designer. He's done a lot of other bits and bobs, you know, lots of other short films and stuff you can find on YouTube, like Repercussion, The Messenger, Pointless, 187. But the problem is that it feels like a much cheaper version of JCVD, Cracker Jack, Welcome to Sudden Death, you know, all these other films that you can name. It doesn't have its own real identity that sort of compensates for the fact that it's this very low budget sort of practically micro budget, I would say. I mean, I think they've given it a good look. There was a Burt Reynolds film also a few years ago, which had a similar concept, but it was about
wanting to be a more serious actor, wasn't it?
He got in that film a bunch of amateurs. The concept was faded big Hollywood star can't get a gig, so his agent sends him to do a play with an amateur dramatic society.
That's right, yeah, it's King Lear.
Yeah.
But that worked because you had a big faded Hollywood star. So the Burt Reynolds factor, this film needed a Burt Reynolds, or, you know, obviously you couldn't get Burt Reynolds, he's dead.
I think it needed to do one or two things. Either go with an actual faded star, you know, sort of Thomas Ian Griffith
Thomas Ian Griffith, yeah.
You know,
which would have tied in with the Crackerjack thing. That would have been really cool, actually.
Yeah.
That would have worked.
Or, you know, do the thing like Tropic Thunder did and do the trailers for the films, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, set it up. Mm. Build the world.
Yeah. I mean, they kind of, you know, they tried to do that with the prologue. But as I said, you know, there's no atmosphere to that scene at all because there's no music. Mm-hmm. You know, you had a little bit of music coming through from the club, but it needed a score to really sort of, you know, give it a bit of weight, and it just wasn't there. So you know, a lot of these scenes do fall a bit flat because of it, unfortunately. I'm a big sucker for films that are actually set on film sets. It is a genre, you know, it's a side genre I really like. You know, films like Green Light, which we covered, Hail Caesar, you know, even, you know, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. There's another really good low budget horror one called The Final Scream, which I'm hoping will turn up on Amazon Prime or somewhere so we can cover it in the throwbacks at one day. I was on board, and Night Shooters, of course, which is a big touchstone for this. It was just, you know, it was just a little too amateurish to enjoy to begin with. There were some good bits, like when he has to do that driving stunt and run somebody over, and he refuses to put his glasses on. You know, that bit I thought was pretty good. There are a couple of bits which did make me chuckle later on, sort of gags during the fight scenes and stuff. But yeah, it's just, I think it's just a little bit too ambitious for its own good. Yeah, it needed more money or some more judicial editing, I think.
Yeah,
I think needed money.
It did need money.
Did need more.
That's the problem. That is kind of the problem. I think that's what's going to make this is a film that only really the hardcore action fans are really going to get anything out of. I think. I think the general public, you know, it's not for them at all.
Yeah,
I mean, we can criticize, pick it apart, or whatever. But there's also, you know, we are finding stuff about it. You know, we're not completely dismissive. I think the general viewers, you know, who watch this, who are not action, you know, big action movie fans or whatever, will just be very, very dismissive. And I would expect to see quite a few harsh reviews. And I don't know, we're being quite critical here, but I think for what it is, you know, for working within the limitations that I've had, I do like what they've achieved here.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think the action team's done really well. You know, again, this is another example of a guy, you know, the director is from the Real Deal Action Team, who I mentioned earlier. You know, that they're, as a gateway or some sort of introductory thing to show you some of what they're capable of, and you know, go and check out some of their other movies like shorts like Evil Twin and stuff. It serves that purpose. You know, it's good for us.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's going to be good for most other people.
You know how Scott Atkins has got that signature kick that he does, where he sort of does a flying spinning kick, fakes with the first leg, kicks with the second leg. You know, he does it in Undisputed.
Is that the Guyver kick?
The Guyver kick, as it's known. Yeah. So that's his sort of, you know, that is his sort of Scott Atkins move. There's something Mike Muller does in here where he flies at two people sideways, kicks one in the head while at the same time punching the other one. And it's absolutely brilliant to watch. I'm thinking, do that again in a bigger film, and you're going to make a name for yourself. But I'm a big fan of Mike Muller. He was in a film called 1 Million Clicks, which was really good. Really enjoyed that one as well.
I want to see that. He did a film with Fred Williamson called Atomic Eden that I haven't seen. He made that just after, or it was really around the same time as 1 Million Clicks, which I also haven't seen, to my shame. But there's loads of other stuff like Camp Vansage or The Challenge, as it's known, or Urban Fighter or Arena of the... Ultimate Justice he was also involved with as well, with Mark Dacascos.
That's right.
He's been around for a long time. He's doing lots of great stuff, but he's just not breaking out, which is a real shame. If nothing else, I hope this film brings him and, you know, his team, you know, more to light, what they can achieve.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Okay, well, we've talked a lot around this. So what are the scores on the doors? I'm going to lead. I'm going to hit this one with a 6 out of 10.
I'm a 6 out of 10 as well.
I'm going to go 5.
Fair enough. Yeah, I think me and Rich got a little bit more out of this than you did, so it's a fair score. So 2 sixes and a 5 for Jack Walker. May he continue in DTV land and we'll see him again. Our next review is The Bike Thief. After a delivery driver's moped is stolen, he must find it before he loses everything else. So this is, it's more of a sort of kitchen sink drama, this one, set in Manchester, I believe, Rich?
I honestly don't know. I presumed it was London, but I didn't really take much note, to be honest.
Yeah, I got a feeling it was Manchester for some reason. So our main hero is an immigrant who isn't named in the script. He's just called the Rider. And, you know, he's not just any delivery driver. He's the best delivery driver this little pizza delivery place has ever seen.
You're making that sound like a lot more exciting.
I know, but so much for the chagrin of some of his other drivers. He's got a wife at home with a young baby, and he's out all night doing these delivery runs all over town. And then, you know, one day he comes out of the shop and someone's nicked his bike, and he has to try and figure out who did it and how to get it back. I was not a fan of this film, Rich, mainly because it is one of these... What I found watching this, really, is that I am a shallow snob at the end of the day, and I watch films for escapism, pure and simple. And this film was sort of presenting this sort of very sort of realistic urban landscape, and this sort of plight of this guy who is, you know, kind of a victim of the system and his own poverty. Is it one of those cases of like, well, you know, he can't afford to insure the bike that he's riding, and as a result of that, when it gets stolen, you know, it comes to haunt him. So I struggled with this, and I found myself sort of skipping through bits as well. So I'm interested to know what your thoughts of it are.
Yeah, I liked it. I mean, it's quite a brisk. I mean, it's dour. You know, it's bleak. But it's a short film. It's only about an hour and 15 minutes long. Plus, you know, less than an hour and 15 minutes long plus credits. the whole. It is kind of a bit like its main character, as it's quite stoic. So he doesn't really say much, he don't really learn very much. You know, it's a gradual process of learning bits of information, but you never get the full story. But it is as you say, it's a kitchen sink drama, a British kitchen sink drama, but it's about an economic migrants, about a Romanian family, specifically the courier, you know, he's a courier of, you know, food, you know, takeaway courier, bike courier, or moped, basically, or something like that. And he's the main character. His wife works as well, but he is kind of the main breadwinner. And if he loses his bike, then, you know, the stakes are high. You know, they couldn't just, it might not be that just that he loses the job, but they could lose the house, they could be homeless and whatever. So it's quite a sobering kind of felt, because you can kind of, you know, you think that this could be, you know, quite real. There is an indication, you know, you start, he's so cagey about talking about himself or any information, you know, that everyone's like, so who is this guy? Where did he come from? Whatever. We don't really know. And he doesn't really want to give any information. Mm. And you, the way it's set up, you kind of wonder, is it going to be a crime film? Mm. You know, is he like a guy who committed a, you know, a murder or something and he's escaped and, you know, somebody's given him a chance? And because there's a whole, it feels a bit like a gangster movie.
Well, I thought it was a bit more straightforward than that, Rich. I was expecting him just to be sort of undocumented, as it were, you know, and sort of worried that sort of the
again. But I was thinking, but why would that be when, you know, it's Romania? I'm Romania in the EU. I mean, there's loads of Romanians over.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, so I don't think there'll be an issue there. I think it's
terms of on his nationality.
Yeah, you probably skipped that bit. so he's got the, you know, it's just the difficulties of trying to find work. And he clearly, they never really established how he ended up with this job. And, you know, with it, the flat, you know, it's all tied together. And the person, you know, his boss, it's his boss's bike, you know, and he doesn't just have to. It's not just a case of replacing the bike, or, you know, the problem with the bike. It's who the bike belongs to and the implications that has, and, you know, in him not wanting to have that conversation and, you know, being cagey about it and stuff. But in terms of it feeling like a bit of a gangster thing, even the guy who's given him the bike and, you know, the guy he works for and who he relies on his livelihood from, it's not like he's some wealthy guy. He looks almost as poor as...
Yeah.
As he does.
It almost looks like he lives in the same block of flats as he does, isn't it?
Yeah, similar. Yeah, so they've got a similar kind of life. So even they're not, you know, it's the, but I guess that's kind of the point almost is, but I don't know, some of it didn't work. The it's a first time feature from a writer director, Matt Chambers, who's done some short films previously. I felt that there were some turns in the story that didn't quite work. Mm-hmm. I thought the portrait of the bleak situation and everything, I thought worked really well. The whole setup of how it ultimately gets to the point where his bike is stolen, which is obviously the main catalyst of the turning point, which happens at the half hour mark, as it usually would. You know, he can't afford to buy a really good lock is the main problem. I thought that was set up quite nicely. He doesn't really want to talk to the police, which seems he's kind of making a problem for himself there. But again, that could have been explained if there was some backstory that, you know, gave us a reason for why he doesn't want to get too involved with the police and doesn't want to tell information, rather than him just being protective of his privacy. Also, how did he cook up with the employer or whatever, but not really too worried about that. But there's a whole bit at the end. There's two things that happen at the end. Mm-hmm. The sort of major events, why it's called the bike thief, you know, because it's not so much about, his bike being stolen, just say that. Mm-hmm. Although there was an indication, not an indication, but you expect that it might go that way. You know, it might be they've stolen his bike, he's going to get it back. You know, Tom Yong-gung, they took my elephant, you know, so he's going to go get his bike back. It doesn't really work out that way. He gets some help, and I was thinking, why would they be doing that? They're sort of, they're putting themselves in jeopardy doing that. And then the climax of the film, I just thought, again, why are certain people taking this side over the other side, and that didn't quite ring true for me. I was thinking that, you know, that it's happening in his favor because the script says it should, rather than it being feeling like a real thing. So, and then it's kind of got an open ending. You're not sure, you know, what's going to happen, and that is kind of left for you to ponder. But I think I have a couple of reservations. Very strong performance, very well directed. you know, very, you know, it's it. I like the fact that the lead character is Romania, but yeah, it's not for everyone. I think that I like the fact that this is something very different that Signature Entertainment have picked up, you know, for the VOD. I'm not sure if it's coming out on DVD, but it's, you know, for the VOD market or whatever.
How are you going to score this one, Rich?
I have to give it a I think there's enough in here for a 7, I would say. I've got a couple of slight reservations, but that's all.
See, I can't fault the technical aspects of this film at all. It is very well made. I just didn't like the script. I don't like, you know,
Here's the thing, Mike. Imagine if the guy on the bike, this the main character, because there's a point where he walks around in the helmet. Imagine he is the character from For the Sake of Vicious. Hold those two films together.
I did think that. Because you're right. He does spend a lot of time with the helmet on. You know,
it's the prequel.
If the prequel was a sort of kitchen sink drama with this sort of like screaming baby and, you know, living in sort of council estate and all the rest of it. I wanted to slip my wrists watching this, really. It's not my cup of tea at all. But I cannot fault the film for its sort of technical aspects. So I'm going to give this a 6 out of 10. Our short chop this week is Batman Other Worlds. As a Keaton-era Batman faces off against Harvey Dent, aka Two-Face, a sudden rupture in the space-time continuum, I'm guessing, sends the Caped Crusader into the world of Adam West-era Batman. Sorry, I got through it eventually. This is fun. As you say, we start off with this sort of Michael Keaton-style Batman facing off against Two-Face, and then something happens, and so he ends up in daylight in this sort of brightly coloured sort of 1960s era America with sort of the Adam West version of Batman and Burt Ward.
Robin, yeah.
Robin. So it's a bit of fun. How did we get on with this, Rich?
Could I throw over to Steve first?
Certainly.
Yeah, okay. It was a bit of fun. Going from, like you said, the Keaton Batman with all the darkness and the gothic action, then all of a sudden it just throws back to Batman 69 and then goes even more meta where it focuses on the director and I presume it's the writer or the producer arguing while Batman continues to beat the shit out of Robin. You know, while you've got, you know, the old school Penguin and Riddler covering their eyes because they've never seen violence like it in their life, you know. it's well shot, good bit of fun, you know. You can't really expand on it anymore. One thing that did make me laugh, though, is when is it starting and you've got, like, the Danny Elfman Batman theme playing in the background and it comes up and says, music by blah, 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 blah. And even my son turned around and went, no, that's the original Batman music. I'm like, yeah, it's...
Okay, so before we continue with this, you mentioned the music. You just reminded me of something. When this film actually starts, it starts in media res. Now, you guys know how I feel about in media res. Anyway, so we get this scene of Batman stood there with the slow motion explosions going on behind him, and then the Johnny Cash version of Hallelujah starts playing. Well,
Leonard Cohen, yeah.
Leonard Cohen. So is it Leonard Cohen? Anyway. And you know, and then it sort of goes, oh, two days earlier. And I thought, fucking hell. But then, as you say, you get the whole Danny Elfman music as he's sort of kitting up, you know, which is really pretty decent scene where he gets all the equipment. And we never get back to that immediate respite because of what happens with the, you know, it cuts to the directors and the thing. Because basically these guys just abandon the project, don't they?
Yeah.
So well, what, you know, we've been doing all this stuff, you know, what do we do? It's like, oh, we'll just call it April Fool's joke or something. But
it's never... like the end of, what is it? The Monty Python and the Holy Grail ending.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But Blazing Saddles sort of thing, but it never resolves its own immediate rest. It's really bizarre, and it was such a bizarre cut between the two. You know, that was that Hallelujah music, sort of really, you know, powerful but morose kind of thing, and then cutting to the Danny Elfman sort of music, sort of building up atmosphere.
I suspect that it was a late addition, because on the making of, he talks about, the Snyder Cut was just about to come out, so we decided to do this bit. We had some stuff, rigged it all with explosives, and we shot this bit. And I don't think that was originally the start of the movie, but they added.
I kind of got that. I kind of realized. I reckon this was a late decision to put this in. But at the same time, I was expecting to see that scene later on in the film.
Yeah.
And then sort of that bit taken out of context and slapped at the beginning. I'm thinking, well, that's probably down to the editor deciding, we need to put a bit of oomph at the beginning of the film or some crap like that. So it was just really bizarre because, as you say, it's got nothing to do with the actual film that we've seen. But there you go.
No. But that's, but in a way, that actually works though, because it contributes to the slap in the face that is the breaking of the fourth wall and the sort of abandoning of the project kind of twist ending thing, which does wrong foot you and will leave, will sort of upset certain viewers. But I think, in retrospect, when I was thinking about it, I was actually, I quite like that they've done something a little bit, different, risky. I mean, the whole, I think this film was, considering what the message is that comes up at the end, I think this was originally supposed to be released on April 1st. Mm-hmm. And in the case of many of these films, it got delayed. And so it didn't get released until the end of end of April. So it says
it's
that,
it's like bursting into a room and going, April Fool, and it's like, no one there, just crickets,
tumbleweeds. Which makes it work, because kind of on April Fool's Day, we kind of expect it.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'll just throw in a couple of additional thoughts.
Of course, yeah.
So this is the latest film from Control Chaos and director Lance Cowas. So they've done a lot of fan films in the past, including The Revenge of the Mask 1 and 2 and The Rise of Odin's 9.
Oh, yep.
Most recently, Jumanji Level 1.
Yep.
And this was announced shortly after that. 10 minutes long. It sets up that 89 Batman kind of world. We've got the 89 Batmobile, which is a replica, which a guy had... they found this guy who'd actually had his own built. So they went over to where he lived and they shot it and whatever. And it all adds great production value.
Yep.
There's this kind of meta. The first sort of meta twist is suddenly being in the 60s, and then we find the contemporary, the more contemporary Batman, the darker, the Dark Knight is back in the land of tights and stuff, and what I like is the way it goes from widescreen to Academy ratio TV thing. I think that all works really nice. The breaking of the fourth wall stuff that then happens, again, is quite a nice. Or the Monty Python whatever ending is quite fun, and what they're trying to convey there is quite, it's quite an interesting way to go about it. So I don't feel hard done by it.
Oh, no,
at all. I am a little bit disappointed. I was kind of hoping for something a little bit more, but I like the fact they got the production value. They got that 89 Batmobile. They got that 60s Batmobile. They've done quite well with the costumes and stuff. There's some fun, the way it's all shot. There was a it does, in terms of the juxtaposition of the different eras of Batman, there is another better film that's...
Before we get on to that, I want to a couple of things to wrap up on.
Go on. Yeah.
So there's a couple of Easter eggs in this one. People will recognise that they sort of borrow from, for example, Batman Returns, the bit with the grappling hook. Sort of shoots at a guy's head, misses, and then he tugs it to sort of knock the guy out.
All really well done.
Yeah, really well done. And then there's sort of dialogue from Dawn of Justice as well, when he sort of goes, "Is that you?" And he goes, "I thought it was you." You know, it's just sort of lines from Batman and Superman. And then, of course, we get, we've been dealing with sort of Keaton era sort of Batman, but then Bale era Batman turns up as well right at the end.
Was that the mid-credit sequence? Yeah.
That's
really cool. Anyway, so you're going to mention the other Batman film, which is sort of slightly older, but has a similar sort of theme to this one.
Yeah, so that was made in 2014. This is called Batman Evolution from director Peter Cornwell. And that is very much a fight scene short. You know, it's they set up the situation, and it's as much about the choreography and you know the way the action is shot as about Batman. But it's essentially doing the same thing as what they've done here, but in that case it's in reverse. Yeah, so it starts out with 60s era '60s Batman becoming the Bale era Batman. So I get your guys' thoughts on how what you thought of that particular film, if you had a chance to see it.
I like the script for this. The character of the Skull, was it Skull? I think his name was
Black Mask.
Of course, because he's the character that Ewan McGregor plays in Birds of Prey. So it didn't quite sort of marry up the two when I was watching it. But it was, you know, quite amusing when he sort of goes, "Oh, you know, I've kidnapped Robin, or should I say Dick Grayson?" And he's like, "How did he find out?" And he goes, "Took his mask off." Which I thought was great. Took that stupid mask off. There he was, Dick Grayson. I really like this. I thought it was a lot of fun. You know, hark back to the TV series, and then you know, sort of as it says, it showed that sort of evolution from Adam West to Christian Bale.
So, what about how they handled that transition with the visual effects and stuff? What do you think of that?
It was pretty cool. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of reminded me of the supposed creation of the Joker, isn't it? You know, him falling into the sort of fat acid or whatever.
Yes.
You know, it's kind of that in reverse. Yeah. It's sort of been covered in this sort of mylar soup sort of stuff and hardened into, you know, his costume.
Yeah, involved.
That's actually real good.
Yeah, and the action, I thought the action's really good. There's members of the 87-11 team involved in it. You know, it's all really good choreography, and a very satisfying action short, I would say, in terms, and it's kind of got it does have a beginning, middle and end in terms of a story, because the idea is Batman having to rescue Robin and confront the Black Mask, and you do get all of that. It all fits in. So it's got quite a nice budget on it, so I don't think Other Worlds is necessarily a worse film than this, but I think they're quite a good double feature to watch together. I think they work. You know, they take the concepts and they do quite different things with it. Other Worlds doesn't have a complete story. But I don't mind that, because it does that Monty Python thing. If you like Monty Python, you'll probably get a kick out of that. So.
They both do a good job of contrasting between the different approaches to Batman.
And I like that they went for, in Other Worlds, I like that they went for 89 Batman rather than Christian Bale Batman, because that's actually a harder aesthetic to do, I think, because, you know, it was the theatricality of the Tim Burton version, wasn't it, versus the real world of Nolan, you know, in terms of Batman Evolution, they have to do the suit, which is probably the hardest part. but they can just set it anywhere. You know, any sort of real world looking warehouse is absolutely fine. Whereas in other worlds, they found a location, they you know, did some lighting, you know, but it's got this artifice, you know, that fits the aesthetic. And then you've got Harvey Two-Face and in it, who wasn't in, obviously, the Tommy Lee Jones played him in the Joel Schumacher version, which I suppose is the touchstone to an extent here. Yeah. Seems quite different.
Well, this is the interesting thing, isn't it? Because in the Tim Burton film, Harvey Dent was played by Billy Dee Williams.
You're absolutely right.
So you got, you know, black actor playing sort of Two-Face within that sort of, you know, Tim Burton era set.
That is a very good point. I think that's quite possibly very intentional on their part. Thinking about it, that's a great little great little thing they did that I hadn't even thought about. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
All right. Well, we don't score the shorts on this show, at least, but we do put them in the footnotes. So we'll put links to both films for you to check out. Let us know what you think. Our DTV throwback this week is Zulu. Policeman Ali Sokela and Brian Epkin investigate the brutal murder of a young white woman, apparently provoked by the availability of a new illegal drug and somehow connected to the disappearance of black street children off the streets of South Africa, Cape Town. So what we've got here, basically, guys, is the South African version of Lethal Weapon. Steve, what did you think of this?
Not Lethal Weapon, it's grim as fuck, this film.
if you turn the nastiness and what some of these characters go through up to 11,
It's cracking, really enjoyable, really tense, but my God, it was grim. It starts off with a father being burnt to death in front of his child and gets progressively worse. But I thought Orlando Bloom was great. Forest Whitaker was great as well. Just the way how stoic he is, as Ali, he's just, I think he's phenomenal in this. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. But the way it starts off as a murder, then it goes so much bigger with, you know, apartheid and trying to basically bring out a molecule that kills black people and then sends them crazy. It's just, didn't expect it to go in that kind of direction. Yeah. You know, you just kind of expected, like say, a murder investigation, but it just gets blown so wide open. Action scenes were great. Even it's so beautiful. Shot. I mean, even in like, you know, in the slums of Cape Town, I presume, and even when it goes into the desert, it reminded me of something like Armor of God at the end of that.
Yeah,
it was so well shot. I really enjoyed this.
Mm-hmm. Rich,
I was pretty blown away by this one. I'd always seen. You know, I'd seen it come when it came, not seen it when it came out, but, you know, I was aware of it. But it didn't appeal. You know, it's Orlando Bloom and, you know, the title Zulu. It doesn't really connect with me. I'm not really that engaged with it. So I put it off until you suggested it. Now, I don't know if you had you seen it before.
I had.
So you knew what we were getting into. And what a pleasant surprise. I mean, an unpleasant surprise in a lot of respects, but obviously. I mean, the fact that you mentioned Lethal Weapon there is interesting because I thought of the same thing because of the, you know, there's a murder that starts the story and there's a black cop and a white cop investigating and whatever. But I guess it's more like something like In the Heat of the Night with Sidney Poitier and Rod Steiger than that, because it's not really an action movie, although there are some action sequences in it. But the it's a French and South African co-production from French director Jerome Sally, I'm not sure how I pronounce, but he did the Largo Winch films, which are You know, we know this is a guy who can do big budget sort of blockbuster kind of aesthetics, and that he also did a film called Anthony Zimmer, which was remade as The Tourist with Johnny Depp and Angelina Jolie, which I didn't see, but I haven't seen the original either. Actually, I did want to. So he's a he's a very accomplished director whose work I have enjoyed. This is something quite different for him, I think. And again, it's done a really, really good job. I mean, the film looks amazing. It's convention. It is a conventional thriller in many respects because it does have that. There's a body. There's a couple of cops investigating. There's quite an fantastical is probably the wrong word, but you know what I mean. It's quite a grand scheme that is unveiled, but it's all very bleak and dark. I mean, the danger of the whole of the environment is always apparent. Orlando Bloom's character is introduced. He's kind of like the Riggs character. He's very on the edge. He's not lost his family. He's not with his family, but they're not, he's not mourning them. But he's really messed up. I think Orlando Bloom does a fantastic job of the character. You know, this is non-South African actors doing South African accents, which is risky, but he does really well. Forrest Whitaker's amazing. I mean, I don't know if he looks like he's slimmed down for this
really
one because
slim and fit in this,
I've never seen him. I've never seen him looking that way. He's brilliant, as you would expect him to be. That beach scene near the start, the way it gets real so fast, and how dangerous these guys are, it's sort of quite breathless, really. You won't forget that in a hurry, and I think the rest of the film pans out, the things about the character, because as Steve was saying, apartheid and the legacy, and the memories of apartheid are so significant. The character Forrest Whitaker plays was, there are horrific consequences that he has faced because of those times that he has to live with. And the dignity that his character has is great, and the sort of the contained rage within in him as well. Whereas Orlando Bloom, he's just like a firework. He's just going off every 5 seconds. There's no restraint with that character, and there is that oil and water sort of the Briggs and Murtaugh kind of thing that plays out. Really much better. I mean, I love it. I think it's a fantastic film.
Yep, totally agree with you guys. When I first saw this, that opening bit is so harrowing, with his dad. And then, later on in the film, we find out what happened to him that same night.
Yeah.
Well.
Jesus.
That's fucking nasty as well. So, the only thing the film doesn't do is really explain what was actually happening at the beginning bit. And did a bit of reading, and it's because his character is he's from the Zulu tribe, and there was a clash with a political party called the IFA, I think it was, who were sort of kind of sponsored by the state police as well. So is a lot of political unrest sort of during the sort of 70s and 80s, as we well know.
This is based on a novel, and I expect that is probably elaborated
on. The investigation, what it comes up with, the fact that this idiot drug dealer sort of screwed up, got a white girl killed, and then which explodes the operation and stuff. It's just really well developed, ekes out this sort of story, and how is. A strange family is sort of pulled into it. It's really good. I really liked Orlando Bloom in this. He's sort of burnt out, but at the same time, cool as a cucumber all the way through. That confrontation on the beach. There's a girl managed to grab his gun. He just kind of continues drinking his beer, and sort of lets that scene play out. I thought it was really cool. That's a really nasty moment. that happens there. And that's when I sort of perked up when I was watching it the first time. I was like, oh my God, this is really...
It's a variation on the setup of the film. Again, it uses all these very conventional stuff like the, hey, we're going into this situation. Hey, have you seen my photo of my family?
Yeah,
you know,
that poor guy, it's like as soon as he sort of says, I didn't realize you're going to sort of join us in the field sort of thing. So, oh no. and his wife's got cancer. It's like, Jesus.
Yeah.
It does it uses conventions, this film, in a similar way to Without Remorse. You know, that film is very much a sort of a by the numbers. You know, here's the thing. Oh, here's the guy. Oh, isn't this his home life, his wife and everything. You know, everything's lovely. And, you know, it's like, there's going to be an event that twists that. And then there's going to be, you know, other things and investigations and stuff. And whereas Without Remorse is very much by the numbers, there's nothing particularly novel about it, apart from the fact that perhaps they went to Russia to film the scene or whatever. This film, it follows all the conventions, but the fact that it's set in this environment that you're not familiar with, you're not as familiar with, unless you've seen like City of God or something, it brings a whole other aspect to it, and it feels fresh, even though it's completely conventional. It's just got this real unique identity. So if you're a fan of, you know, thrillers, you know, you get everything that you would expect if you were, you know, you're flicking through the latest, thriller that you've picked up or a book, you know, in the supermarket or something. You get all the conventional stuff, but you get all these other layers to it as well. I think that's the great thing about it.
Absolutely. It is a really solid film, really good sort of procedural, really good action moments. You know, it's not an action movie, but as we said, you know, they do sort of pepper the film with these sort of little shootouts and little chases and things, which really, really work. Two really good actors sort of leading this. It's just really solid. I think the only thing really holding the film back up till now is the title. Yeah, people see the title and immediately go, Michael Caine, Stanley Baker, you know. Obviously, you know, you might think, oh, it's a remake or something. It's not. It's just a really good contemporary thriller set in Cape Town.
It was called A Most Violent City in South Africa, apparently. Or the most violent city, something like that. It was. Yeah. I can't find a poster of it, but apparently that's what they called it over there.
That sounds a more intriguing title to me. The UK DVD cover for this had a tagline which just said a new breed of warrior, you know.
Yeah, that's not good.
Cringed when I read that because I put something on Facebook about it the other day, and as soon as I read that, I thought, oh God, it just sounds awful. It really does. Anyway, we don't score the throwbacks, but we certainly recommend this. It's on Prime. Please check it out and let us know what you think. And that is the end of this week's show, so thank you for listening. Thank you to Rich and Steve for joining me. Don't forget to check out our other show, the DTV Digest Short Shots, where we look exclusively at short films. That also has its own Twitter page, as do we. At the DTV Digest, both on Twitter and Facebook. So check us out. Other than that, thank you for listening and tune in again next time.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.